Thank you so much, Pastor Phelps. Thank you, Colonial, for hosting this FBFI. It's been a joy. I hope you pastors can agree with me. We appreciate so much the church family and allowing them to utilize this wonderful facility. A lot of work goes in behind the scenes, and there's a lot of folks that their names will never be up there on the overhead, but we thank you for your work and your hosting us this week. Let me mention a couple of things just quickly. It's intimidating for me to be able to follow up on Dr. John Whitcomb this afternoon, a great patriarch, a hero of the faith. You folks are blessed to have him here from time to time and part of the audience, but for us it was a treasure to be able to hear from him today. But also to have Dr. Bob in the audience, to have Dr. Phelps in the audience, these are heroes of mine. When Dr. Phelps came and took over as pastor of our church, I was teaching some of this type of material in the teen Sunday school. And Dr. Phelps said, you come on up, I'd like you to teach this for the adults. And then pretty soon he heard about someone who needed to fill the pulpit, and he said, you know what, Dave, why don't you go fill the pulpit over there? And he kind of nudged me along, so I owe him a debt of gratitude for where I am today in this ministry. But it is the burden of my heart to share the passions of our great Creator. What a wonderful theme for the FBFI this year, Declarations from Our Designer. Folks, this is a timely theme. We are seeing the early chapters of Genesis under assault like never before. This is no accident. Make no mistake. The devil knows what he's doing. If he can undermine the foundations, everything else starts to slip and fall. And so we need to be prepared to take a stand. And that's part of the burden of what this topic tonight is, five Q's or five questions for evolutionists. I have a little pamphlet that I've prepared that goes along with this particular talk called Five Q's for Evolutionists. There's a number of these up front. Feel free to come by. This is not just for pastors, but grab one, stick it in your Bible. It might be something that you can review at a later date. If you have a friend who's an evolutionist and you can put it to use, grab a couple of them. Happy just to provide them free of charge for you folks. Let me ask, just kind of by way of getting acquainted with who's out here, how many of you had a chance to hear the Bill Nye Ken Ham debate a couple of years ago? Great, a whole bunch. You guys are close to AIG headquarters here, so I'm not surprised by that. Anytime as creationists that we have the opportunity to get on a stage and discuss creation and evolution and have a forum, that's wonderful. But one of the things that's sometimes a bit of a disappointment to me is that I find the focus is on the challenges to the creation model. And I like to see the spotlight shifted just a bit to some of the challenges with the evolutionary model, because there are big problems that don't seem to see the light of day in the public forum. And so that's part of the burden of this five Q's or five questions for evolutionists. Can we switch over to my, have I got everything plugged in all right up here? Looking up at the technical people. Okay, you got a great picture of me and my son. Let me see if I can power this back up again and we'll get on the air. There we go. Technology is a wonderful thing when it works. We won't say what it's like the rest of the time. Five Q's, five questions for evolutionists. Ken Ham and a gentleman named Beamer wrote a book called Already Gone. And the point of the book is that so oftentimes young people are lost at an early age. They're lost even in our Sunday schools. They're lost in our youth groups because the foundational issues haven't been addressed. And all it's going to take is some college professor nailing them, questioning them, and their faith is shipwrecked. And so part of my burden is to inoculate young people. I see some young people in here tonight. Obviously, you pastors represent churches that are full of young people. And may I suggest to you that there is a need to address these issues, these fundamental issues, so that someday when they get to a community college, a tech school, or even the workplace, maybe in a master's program, and some professor says, young man, young woman, how can you believe in creation? That's merely faith. I hold to science. And the presumption there is, well, there's no evidence for what you believe. You're just taking a leap in the dark. For me, on the other hand, these things are hard facts. We've observed them. They've gone through the scientific method. It's been rigorous. And if something came up to the contrary, I'd happily change my opinion. Whereas you, on the other hand, are just blindly following this particular tradition. Folks, that's exactly the opposite of reality. But these professors make sport of ruining the faith of our young people. You might say, well, that's a pretty strong statement. Let me tell you the story of Jesse Kilgore. Jesse Kilgore grew up in a Christian home. His dad had been a chaplain in the military. He himself served in our armed forces and did a tour of duty in Iraq. When he came back, he went to a community college and enrolled in a program, and he was sitting in a biology class. He tried to take a stand for the Lord there in a secular setting, doing some apologetics work. He got made fun of by his peers, criticized by the professor, and pretty much everybody ganged up on him. And finally, as he tried to take a stand, the professor challenged him and said, "Jesse, you need to go and get a copy of Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion. That'll straighten you out." And Jesse did it. And we know he finished the book because his bookmark was on the last page. And by the time he had finished reading this blasphemous little book, he told a friend this. He said, he was pretty much an atheist. No belief in the existence of God in any form or any afterlife or even the concept of right or wrong. Shortly after he explained that to his friend, he took a gun. He went out the woods behind his house in New York State and killed himself. Is there implications to what we teach young people in school? Sure there is. Now that's a tragic story on a number of fronts. It's a tragedy that a young person would be so extreme as to do that without consulting. But there's great answers. I mean, this book is, from a scientific perspective, it's pretty good. Dawkins is a biologist, teaches at Oxford University. From a philosophical perspective, it's sophomoric at best. Just good answers to the things in this book. We'll talk about some of them today. It's also a tragedy that a professor and a bunch of students would gang up on somebody to the point where they'd hit that frustration level and end it all. Can you imagine the outcry if the person had been of an alternative lifestyle and had been mocked and had committed suicide? But you've probably never heard the story of Jesse Kilgore. But it's also a tragedy that millions of people have forgotten the wonder and the glory of the first chapters of Genesis that lay the foundation for our entire faith. And I want to talk about that for just a little bit, because the Bible says, "Sanctify the Lord God in your hearts and be ready." Be ready always to give an answer to every man that asks you a reason of the hope that's in you with meekness and fear. Here is a command to do apologetics, to be prepared, to have an answer, to have thought this thing through, to address the big issues of our society. But not only does it tell us to do that, it tells us the way we're to do it. We're to do it with a spirit of meekness and fear. Someone has said an accusation hardens the will, where a question will stir the conscience. And that's the burden of my talk for you tonight. Five cues, five questions for evolutionists. Hopefully you won't hear from me a demeaning or an arrogant spirit. That's not what we need. We need folks that have a true love for atheists and agnostics. People that need the gospel. A heart of compassion for those. That we might be able to share Jesus Christ with them. So what I'm going to do, I want you to remember these five cues. I'm going to say them, and then we're all going to say them together. Can you play along with me tonight? I know it's Wednesday night, but let's have some fun. Five cues. Question number one. Where did it all come from? Let's say it. Where did it all come from? Hey, pretty good. You guys get a B. We'll get better as we go along. Where did it all come from? We live in a cause and effect world. This is one of the most fundamental laws in all science, is cause and effect. We see something happen, a building explode maybe, and we're not going to stop it. Oh, I guess it was its bad day. We're going to go check it out. Why did that building collapse? We don't want buildings collapsing. What happened? Was it an error in the construction? Was it a terrorist act? We want to know the cause. Because buildings don't just collapse. We live in a cause and effect world. Sometimes it's the other way around. We know, okay, we're desiring a particular effect. We're desiring to heal you of a particular disease. You go to the doctor. We know the effect we want. We're going to try different causes. Let's try this medicine, see how that does. If it doesn't work good, give me a call back in a week and we'll try something else. We live in a cause and effect world. It's one of the most fundamental laws of all science. Well, what effect brought about the universe's existence? What chicken laid this egg? Where did it all come from? Now, if you ask an evolutionist that, what will they say? Somebody help me out. Big Bang, right? Big bang. You see, there was this ginormous explosion. And the whole universe came from a big bang. Now, if somebody tells you that, don't stop there. Say, okay, where did the big bang come from? And sometimes they'll get a queer look on their face like, you're not supposed to ask that. It's a singularity, you know. We're not supposed to, you know, ask questions. Hey, look, we live in a cause and effect world. What caused the big bang? And every once in a while you get someone who's kind of smart on particle physics and they'll say something like this. There was this vapor cloud that condensed down to a tiny little pea size and then kaboom, exploded in the big bang. And then what should you say? You got it! Where did the vapor cloud come from? We still live in a cause and effect world. It's the fundamental law of science, right? Now listen to me. At the end of the day, there's only one of three possibilities. I've done this talk all over this country and in many foreign countries, and there's only one of three possibilities. Possibility number one. That is the eternality of matter. Matter in some form was always there. Now, if we look back at the Humanist Manifesto, written way back in 1933, they say this, tenet number one, religious humanists regard the universe as self-existing. It was not created. They believe in the eternality of the universe. Stuck out there. That's all there is. Everything that is out there. That's all that ever was. I like this definition of atheism. The lights are on, but nobody's home. Now, folks, there's a fundamental scientific problem with this idea of eternality of matter. The universe is winding down. We don't see anything winding up. At one point, it was wound up. All we see is it's winding down. It's called the laws of thermodynamics. Things go from an ordered state to a disordered state. Like a little boy who came home from school says, "Hey, Mommy, they told me in Sunday school today that when God made man, he made man from the dust of the ground. Is that true?" His mom said, "Well, it's true." He says, "And then they said that when man dies, he goes back to the dust of the ground. Is that true?" His mother said, "Well, it's true too." The little boy thought a minute. He said, "Mom, there is somebody either coming or going underneath my bed right now." Things go downhill, don't they? You don't clean your house, it turns into a mess. We see our country going downhill right now. Eternality of matter, it's not a scientific position. It's a position of faith that runs against some of the best established laws of science, the laws of thermodynamics. Well, there's a second possibility, and that is there was nothing, and all of a sudden, kapow, you got the whole universe from absolutely flat zero nothing. You say, wow, does people really believe that? Oh, yeah, this is General Science, the annotated teacher's edition. I'm going to read from page 362. It says, in the realm of the universe, nothing really means nothing. Not only matter and energy would disappear, but also space and time. However, physicists theorize that from this state of nothingness, the universe began in a gigantic explosion about 16.5 billion years ago. Isn't that the ultimate free lunch? Here's Discover, April 2002. The universe burst into something from absolutely nothing, zero, nada. Here's a quote from Paul Davies. He is an atheist, brilliant physicist. And Professor Davies says this, "The Big Bang represents the instantaneous suspension of physical laws. The sudden, abrupt flash of lawlessness that allowed something to come out of nothing. It represents a true miracle, transcending physical principles." Now, I thought these are the guys that had no use for the miracles that were in the Bible. We can't have creation because that's a miracle. We got to live by the laws of science. Excuse me? So it's okay to have a miracle so long as it protects your pet theory? How is this any more scientific than in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth? See, folks, it's a position of absolute and total faith. But it's a faith that flies against the laws of science, the conservation of matter, something from nothing. We don't observe that happening anywhere in the known universe. It's a position of faith. Well, there's one other possibility. Scientists don't like talking about it as a rule, but it's an intelligent design. That's all you've got. Now, we see design coming from designers. That we observe. That's scientific. Now, I give these talks in different places, including seculars. I've been in public school a couple times this last year, in the University of Wyoming last year. And invariably, someone will raise their hand in the Q&A time and say, "Well, I've got a question for you. Where did God come from then?" I'll play your same game back on you. In fact, Dawkins in his nasty little book, puts a whole chapter out there which basically asks this question, and he more or less assumes that he's disproved God just by asking that question. So if someone come to you and say that, what would you say? How would you respond? And the crowd murmured amongst themselves. Any brave soul want to raise their hands out there? I won't pick on you. That's okay. We got a big group here. Oh, yes. Okay, brother. He's always existed, which is very true. But how is that different than saying the universe always existed? You know, we criticize them for that. God is a person. Okay. You're getting close here to what I'd say. We're kind of nibbling on the edges of it. All the way over there. Okay, his existence doesn't defy the laws of physics. Yes. He's perfect, very good. He's all things are true. I'll take one more right over here, brother. He's not matter. That's probably the closest yet. Listen, guys, we're talking about natural laws. Right? The law of cause and effect. Is God subservient to the natural laws that he created? No, right? They didn't exist till he created them, right? And so, if you want to say, here's a big box, and everything that exists is in this box called naturalism or the natural world, well, then everything has to obey the natural laws, including the law of cause and effect. That's the problem of the evolutionist. But we've got someone living outside the box. God, who by anybody's definition is supernatural and doesn't obey the natural laws, right? They got a problem. I don't have a problem. Psalm 19 verse 1 says, the heavens declare the glory of God. And the firmament shows his handiwork. Wonderful scientific statement. The cosmological argument. Okay, question number one was, somebody tell me, where did it all come from? Question number two, wait for it. How could a big bang create an ordered universe? Let's say it. How could a big bang create an ordered universe? You know, we know a little bit about explosions. We do them once in a while. What if I were to tell you this? I looked out my window, and there a couple blocks down from me, down the street, there's a printing press, big building. And as I was looking out my window, all of a sudden, there was this huge explosion. This fireball, the whole building went up. And I was worried maybe someone was down there. Well, there wasn't. But I came down there, and lo and behold, there's this dictionary. I got a dictionary out of it. I went check out, make sure it's okay. Look, this dictionary came out of the explosion. Now, some of you guys are chuckling a little. Why are you chuckling? It's not possible. Why is it not possible? I mean, they have print, ink in there. They've got all the paper in there. They got everything they need to make a Webster's dictionary in the building. Well, Dave, don't you understand? Explosions randomize things. They don't make things orderly. They don't increase information. Like, for example, we explode our enemy's tanks. Bad little ISIS guy coming along. We drop a bomb on it. It randomizes the tank. Doesn't make it a better tank. Explosions don't create order. You would be correct. And so when we think about this particular question, how could a Big Bang create an ordered universe, we're not so much talking about how the universe get there. We're talking about its character. Why is the universe rational, operating under laws that permit scientific inquiry? I drop this book and it goes down as far as it can, lands on the pulpit. It's the law of gravity. Well, what if maybe 10 times out of 100 you dropped it, it just floated off? We wouldn't have a law of gravity, would we? And we can envision universes where things are really random and unpredictable. You couldn't even have science, could you? Because there wouldn't be laws, you couldn't replicate experiments, you couldn't make predictions because it would be a random universe. Well, why wouldn't that come out of an explosion rather than an ordered universe? How about this? Is the ideal environment for life on Earth a product of a mindless chance? Come on. Beautiful, ordered environment. I'm looking for a young person now. I want some young person to tell me if in the orbit of the Earth around the sun, we were a little bit closer to the sun and we went around a real tight orbit, what would happen to us? We would be crispy critters! If we were a little further out in the orbit and we're going around, what would happen to us? We'd be frozen icicles! You see, it has to be very carefully put together like a fine Swiss watch. The universe is extremely fine-tuned for life even to exist. Let me give you just one little factor. The expansion of the universe. A guy named Greg Easterbrook did some calculations. He said the cosmos is hurtling outward at a remarkably balanced velocity. If the expansion were slightly less, the universe would have collapsed back on itself soon after its birth. If it were slightly more rapid, the universe would have dispersed into thin soup with no aggregated matter. Now get this, the ratio of matter and energy to the volume of space at the birth of the universe must have been within 1/4 of 1% ideal. Now that's looking at one factor, the expansion. You can look at the gravitational constant. You can look at the strong nuclear force, the weak nuclear force, and there's lots of these things. And folks, this is like me coming to you and saying, hey, I won the lottery 1,000 times in a row. I'm rich. You'd say, what? I've never met anybody that won the lottery. To win it twice in a row, the FBI would come in and start doing an investigation to see how you rigged it. You saying you won it 1,000 times in a row? That's what the evolutionists want you to believe. I don't have that kind of faith. I don't have that kind of just wild, ridiculous faith to believe something like that. It's unreasonable. Here's a quote from Paul Davies, again an atheist. Scientists are slowly waking up to an inconvenient truth. Well, it's inconvenient for Paul Davies and his buddies. The universe looks suspiciously like a fix. The issue concerns the very laws of nature themselves. For 40 years, physicists and cosmologists have been quietly collecting examples of all too convenient coincidences and special features in the underlying laws of the universe that seem to be necessary in order for life and hence conscious beings to exist. Wow. It's put together like a Swiss watch. And so the evolutionist looks at that and says from an atheistic perspective, whoa, it's a very fortunate accident. Pretty cool. A Christian looks at that exact same evidence and says, incredible design. There must be a great designer. The Bible says in Romans 1:20, for the invisible things of him, that's God, from the creation of the world are clearly seen. How can we see God? Being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so they are without excuse. Okay, question number one was, where did it all come from? Some of you guys are cheating. I see you looking at your notes. Bunch of cheaters out there. Where did it all come from? Question number two. Okay, that was tough. How could a Big Bang create an ordered universe? Question number three is one of my favorites. How can you get life from rocks? How do you get life from rocks? You know, they used to believe if you put out meat all by itself, just let it kind of decay, it breeds maggots. Meat plus time equals maggots. Life just kind of comes out of this decaying meat. And then in the 1860s, you had Louis Pasteur, of course, Francisco Redi. Some of you guys remember this from biology class. His famous disproof of spontaneous generation, that you get life from non-life. And he's put these nutrients in a jar. He pasteurized it. He sealed it really good. And we still use that term pasteurization for our milk because of Louis Pasteur, who was a Christian, by the way. And he sterilized these jars and he found out, look, nothing breeds in them. Why? Because the life comes from outside. The bacteria, the flies laying their eggs on the meat and the maggots coming out of it. And he established what we call today the law of biogenesis. Why is it a law? There are absolutely zero known exceptions to it. So how are you going to get life from rocks? On a primitive planet that's finally cooled enough to have a little bit of water, from just water and rocks, how are you going to get life? The law of biogenesis with no known exceptions says only life begets life. So this effectively kills the whole Darwinian story of goo to you via the zoo. Because if you need a creator's hand to kind of get the life started, why couldn't he just make the lives in the forms we have today and be done with it? We don't need evolution. Did you know there's no such thing as simple life? That's an oxymoron. The more that we study about the simplistic, single-celled creature, the more we appreciate the complexity and even the tiniest little microscopic organism. We used to think that simple-celled creatures were maybe a little bit like buildings. That, you know, had the, you know, complexities of a building. Today we think more in terms of a city and the complexities of a city with and outside wall and transportation systems and waste disposal systems and energy plants and information libraries. Speaking of information libraries, do you know that if we took your chromosomes and stretched them out, they'd go back and forth to the moon 100,000 times? That's how much information it takes to make a you. That's your recipe. Your DNA could be put inside a teaspoon, and yet it contains more information than all the world's supercomputers combined. Someone did a calculation, and they said the probability of one DNA arranging itself just by accident, calculated as 1 in 10 to the 119,000. Give you an idea how big that number is. The whole of the visible universe with our scanning electron telescopes is only 10 to the 28 inches in diameter. So what's the chance of something like that happening by itself, an unguided process on this earth? But the evolutionists believe it. Here's a guy who won a Nobel Prize, George Wald. He says time is, in fact, the hero of the plot. Given so much time, the impossible, he admits it's impossible, becomes possible. The possible, probable. And the probable, virtually certain. One has only to wait, and time itself performs miracles. There's that word again. Oh, they're not religious, are they? They don't have faith. Everything is pure observation, right? What if I told you I got a whole bunch of monkeys and put them in front of computers, and what do you know, kazam, they rewrote all the entire works of Shakespeare. Next week we're going to work on something else, right? You see, that's craziness. They'd just destroy the whole lab. The computer lab would be an utter wreck, right? They don't create order. Random processes do not create information. Someone says, well, haven't scientists created life in the laboratory? No, they have not. They took some heated up water, they added some methane, ammonia, and they bit a spark, and at the bottom some red goo collected in this experimental apparatus, and that red goo had some amino acids, which are some very simplistic chemicals that are the building blocks for proteins, which are the building blocks for your body's machines. So there's several steps below creating even a basic machine necessary to run in a cell, which makes life. And even if you did have life, if you put it in that environment, methane, ammonia, hydrogen, and sparks, guess what happened to it? You'd kill it. Right? And if all you needed was the rough building blocks, well, I mean, you could take a frog, put him in a blender, and mix him up real good. You got all the building blocks for a frog. Is it going to turn into a frog if you give it some time? You're going to get a sad frog. Or a gooey mess. I don't care how many years you give it, you're not going to get another frog out of it. And yet you read stuff in the textbooks like this. Swirling in the waters of the oceans is bubbling broth of complex chemicals. Progress from complex chemical soup to a living organism is very slow. Well, yeah, I guess so. Like it's never going to happen. Here's another textbook. Look at this. The first self-replicating system must have emerged in this organic soup. You read about this soup. This magical soup. I'm waiting for Campbell's to come out with primordial soup. And the kids are going to say, there's our grandpapa right there. Let's have him for dinner. Acts 17, verse 25 says, He, God, give to light all life and breath and all things. A more scientifically instructive statement can hardly be imagined. Question number one was, where did it all come from? Question number two. How could a Big Bang... You guys are having a tough time with that. How could a Big Bang create an ordered universe? Question number three. You got that one. Good, that's good. How do you get life from rocks? Question number four. How could biological systems assemble by accident? How could biological systems assemble by accident? You know, there's a lot of complex systems. Even if you got life from rocks, when you start looking at things like an eyeball or a sonar system in bats or wings in birds. Well, don't you know, Dave, wings and birds came from dinosaurs. Well, long before you've got a dinosaur that has a wing that can fly, he'd have a useless limb that he couldn't even walk good, and he'd be the first thing to get eaten in the struggle for existence. Charles Darwin looked at the eyeball and he said this in his book. Oh, you guys like that. Okay. To suppose the eye could have been formed by natural selection seems, I freely confess, absurd in the highest degree. That's what he said in his book. But he had to believe it. It's part of his theory. So he took his best stab at it. Do you know within the retina of your eye, in less than one square inch, there's 137 million light-sensitive cells? Well, we talked about the complexity in one cell. That's less than a square inch. The complexity of biological systems is mind-boggling. Maybe I could illustrate it to you in a really, really simple way. Life's complex systems are a little bit like a mouse trap. They could not assemble piece by piece unless they were all together, because they confer no advantage unless all the machinery is in place. Now, I'm a highly trained scientist. I don't suggest you do this at home. I am bravely setting this mouse trap, despite the fact that I've hurt myself doing this. Okay, there we go. Now, don't you get nervous in the front row. I know what I'm doing. I've got this thing all under complete control. If I was to arbitrarily take away one of these pieces, how many mice would I catch? Zero. Why? It wouldn't work at all, right? It doesn't add a little bit of advantage, or you maybe catch a few mice, but not quite as many. And so the point of a guy by the name of Michael Behe in his great book, Darwin's Black Box, is this. How can you assemble something that's complicated, one little mutation at a time over millions of years, if there's no advantage? Unless all the machinery is in place, it's just taking up resources in the creature, it would be selected against. And a mousetrap, I mean, we got six pieces, that's nothing compared to the human immune system or the blood clotting cascade or your eyeball. Right? Let me show you a bacteria flagellum. This is cool. You're going to like this. This is the little thing that sits on the back of a bacteria and drives it through the water. This is a little outboard engine. You can almost see one scientist looking in his microscope saying, "Hey, Charlie, come here. Look at this. I got an outboard engine in my microscope." If you're walking along the beach and you saw this thing, you'd say, "Hey, somebody dumped an outboard engine there." This is on the back end of a little tiny E. coli. It's what allows it to swim through your body and infect you, travel through the water. But this is an outboard engine like you have never seen before. This thing can run at 100,000 RPM. Now, some of you guys are into mechanics here. Try running your car at 100,000 RPM, see what'll happen. Can you say meltdown? Jet engines run at 100,000 RPM. But this thing is so cool, it can stop in a quarter of a turn and change directions. Try doing that with a jet engine. Meltdown. This little outboard engine is so tiny you can put 8 million of them across a human hair. Wow. Amazing, incredible design. Here's a little graphic of this fellow. Look at it whizzing along. Now, all these pieces, the rotors, the stators, the hook joint, all that, if you were missing one of those pieces, what would happen to the bacteria? Dead in the water. All the pieces have to be in place for you to have a functioning bacteria. How are you going to get that little piece by little piece? I don't have that kind of faith. Evolutionists say, oh, it's mutations, it's random changes, it's lucky accidents. We've never observed a single mutation that added new information to a gene. Mutations are accidents. At best, they reshuffle existing information. At worst, you lose things. And strange stuff happens, like this two-headed turtle. Werner Gitt, director of the German Federal Institute of Physics, said this: information only arises through an intentional, volitional act. There is no known natural law through which matter can give rise to information. Neither is there any physical process or material phenomenon known that can do this. Psalm 139, verse 14 says, I will praise thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Amen. Okay, question number one was, where did it all come from? Question number two. Okay, you guys are getting better. I can tell you're reading it. Question number three. I kind of helped you out there. Question number four. Good. Got some laggards there in behind. Question number five. Why do we have a soul? Let's all say it. Why do we have a soul? Why do we have a soul? This is a problem for evolutionists. You might not have thought of this before, but it really is. It's pretty significant. You see, we have something that's fundamentally different about humans. I could take you out to a tree. We could crank up a chainsaw. Is the tree going to say, ouch? No, it's going to go, duh, and fall over, right? Now, how about this guy? If I took a chainsaw to him, is he going to say, ouch? Well, he might not say, ouch. He might go, or something like that, right? There's a little something different going on up there than it has in the tree. But follow me. No ape has ever written a poem. No dolphin has ever said, where did I come from? Where am I going? You say, my dog loves me. Well, the dog might just know which direction his food's coming from. But no dog has ever written a book on philosophy or built an altar. There's something fundamentally different inside man. We call it a soul. Why do we have a soul? Evolutionists have tried to push this idea that humans are nothing but a moist robot. But such materialism doesn't square with our human experience. Ravi Zacharias wrote this, we know that without God there's a loss of the sense of wonder and meaning in life. What's Ravi mean by that? Maybe I can best illustrate by quoting a couple of atheists. At the end of their life, this is where their philosophy took them. This is Bertrand Russell, a brilliant man, logician, an atheist. He wrote this, man is the product of causes that had no prevision of the ends they were achieving. His origin, his growth, his hopes, his fears, his loves, his beliefs. How about the outcome of an accidental co-location of atoms? No fire, no heroism, no intensity of thought and feeling can preserve an individual life beyond the grave. Very cold, very deterministic, futile view of life. Very sad way to live. Here's Francis Crick, Nobel Prize winner, co-discoverer of the DNA double helix. He says, you, your joys, your sorrows, your memories, your ambitions, your sense of personal identity, your free will are nothing more than the behavior of a vast assembly of nerve cells and their associated molecules. You're nothing but a pack of neurons. Wow. So this guy that commits a crime over there, he's just dancing his molecules in his head. Don't get mad at him. He's just doing what he's doing. You over here have been loyal to us and served as a chaplain in our military and done this great act. Okay, we don't want to celebrate you because you're just obeying your neurons. It's just chemistry. Is that all life is? Chemistry? Darwin himself said something very interesting at the end of his life. As Darwin developed his evolutionary theory, his spiritual and aesthetic faculties atrophied. He wrote, up to the age of 30, poetry, pictures gave me considerable and music very great delight. But now, for many years, I cannot endure a line of poetry. I've almost lost my taste for pictures or music. See, the great Christian philosopher Blaise Pascal famously said, there's a God-shaped hole in the soul. Something missing. Why? Why do we have a soul? Eccles and Robinson, brilliant scientists, Nobel Prize winners, they spent their life studying the mind. Experiments when people's minds were opened up and they did experiments on them with their consent. Near-death experiences, and they did this, their whole life study was the mind. And at the end of it all, they wrote this, we believe the emergence of consciousness is a skeleton in the closet of orthodox evolutionism. In Dawkins' little book, The God Delusion, this jumped out at me on page 168. He says this, after discussing the improbable step of the origin of life, the origin of consciousness might be another major gap whose bridging was on the same order of improbability. Oh, really? Got thinking about that a little bit. Why is Professor Dawkins troubled by the origin of consciousness? Why is it he says it's improbable? Why is it keeping him up at night? Let me illustrate. Let's say this half of the room, all you nice folks over here, are herbivores. You're cuddly little creatures that eat plants and mind your own business. These guys over on this side are carnivores, nasty in tooth and claw, eating up herbivores. And the herbivores over here have gotten to where they've gotten by an evolutionary process of struggle for existence and survival of the fittest. And by stepping on each other along the way and trying to get the best food for themselves and the most mates to leave the most genes, that's how they've gotten ahead. And somebody gets a slight mutation that gives him a slight advantage, and he steps on some other folks and he gets the best goodies and leaves the most progeny, and eventually the population gets that mutation, and that's how you've all gotten where you are. Survival of the fittest. And then all of a sudden, one person, Andy Dean right here, has a mutation for conscience. Stand up, Andy. Andy's the first gentleman. I didn't warn him. Thank you, Andy. But he's the first gentleman. And he and everyone else is eating and doing and stepping on everybody. And he's over there by the woods saying, where did I come from? Where am I going? What good things can I do for my fellow herbivores? And all of a sudden, in this peaceful, tranquil scene, here come the carnivores. They're coming up over the hill. And all the herbivores look, oh no! And they go running for the forest. And I start running too because they're scary. They got teeth and claws. And I'm running. And I trip. And I go down. And I break my leg. And all the rest of you herbivores look back and say, oh, tough on Dave Wetzel. You're gone. Except Andy. He's here. He says, come on, Dave. Hang on. We can do this. Gets me up. And we're going along. Guess what's going to happen to him? He's going to get out for dinner. Thank you, Andy. Appreciate it. There is no evolutionary benefit to having a conscience. And so Richard Dawkins stays up at night and it bothers him. Why? Why do we have a soul? Romans 1 verse 19 says, because that which may be known of God is manifest where? In them. For God hath showed it unto them. I'm wondering if there's anybody that's brave enough to give me all five cues. Every once in a while, I guess. You want to try? Go ahead. Stand up. Universe. Good. And why? Thank you very much. Let's hear it for her. Good job. Excellent. I've done this at the Wilds, and I usually get a couple, three young people every summer. I'd like you to come back afterwards. See me back by the bookstore. I've got a little thing I want to give you. There it is, folks. Five questions. Where did it all come from? How could a Big Bang create another universe? How can you get life from rocks? How could biological systems come by accident? And why do we have a soul? Five simple things to ask in a sweet spirit. So hopefully, if you someday run into an evolutionist, they throw that at you, you can say, sir, can I ask you five questions about origins? You see, I believe creation is the better model. It's not an option. We are commanded to let our speech be always with grace, seasoned with salt, that we might know how you ought to answer every man. I'm a scientist, and that's an interesting statement for me because salt has some pretty amazing properties. Salt has a preservative effect. They ate salt pork before they took it out to sea because it would last virtually forever. It preserves things from decay. If you're salty, you're going to help preserve a sphere of influence round about you. Salt also has therapeutic benefits. You know, they bottle up the minerals of the Dead Sea and Salt Lake and they ship it all over the world and people can smear it on themselves and people go in these salt baths and these mineral baths and supposedly it's really good for you. I'm believing them for it. I do know it has antiseptic, so if you had a cut and you were afraid it was getting a bacteria, you could put some salt, might burn like crazy, but actually would help therapeutically. And lastly, salt adds flavor. Are you adding flavor to the world around about you? Are you just flotsam and jetsam going through your community every day? Jesus said, you are the salt of the earth. But if the salt hath lost its savor, wherewith will it be salted? You're not going to take some salt. Hey, this salt lost its flavor. Let's get some salt and put it in this so it'll get salty again. You're just wasting that, right? So what are you going to do with it? You're going to do exactly what Jesus said. It's thenceforth good for nothing but to be cast out and trod under the foot of men. What good are you in your community if you've got no testimony? If you're not engaged in the battle for souls? Folks, you've got a mission field right here. You don't have to be a chaplain. You don't have to be in the full-time service. You don't have to go off to Africa. There are souls next door. There are souls in your workplace. You need to be burdened for souls right here in India. Have you got a list of folks you're praying for? Have you reached out to your neighbors? Folks, life is quick. It's going to be gone like that. We're going to be standing before Jesus Christ. You think it's going to matter what your neighbors might have said to you? You think it's going to matter that you get tongue-tied? You think it's going to matter? God made the tongue. You think he can take care of you? We're talking to infinite God. Go do something for Jesus Christ. God could just shoop, take us all to heaven as soon as we get saved. But he leaves us here. Why? Because he has a purpose for you. You're to be salt in your community. So my question for you tonight in closing is this. What on earth are you doing, for heaven's sake? What on earth are you doing for heaven's sake? Every head bowed, every eye closed. Just before I turn it over to Dr. Phelps, I want to challenge you about how you look at life. Is life something that we're here to survive and get through? Is life something that we're here to enjoy as much as we can and grab all the goodies on the way by? Or is life for you a battle for the never dying souls of men? Is life for you a chance to have an impact in your community? Father, I pray that you might cause us to examine ourselves. Life is short. It goes so fast. Precious souls are hanging in the balance. People we meet in the restaurant, gas station, our work associates that have never heard from us the gospel message. God, may we get serious about this thing of fighting the fight, of impacting a world. Lord, the evolutionists are winning the fight. God, we say, do a great work again. Do a work of revival. Do a work of revival on this pace. To your honor and glory. In Christ's name we pray.